session number 11092, reel 1.
Colonel Wood, reel 1. How did you come to be involved with the Pegasus Bridge operation, please?
I think perhaps I should go back, first of all, to when I was at 165 Octu in Scotland, Dunbar, when on 3 days before the course was over, the posting list was put out, and I found myself posted to the Oxfordshire and Buckinghamshire Light Infantry, of which, to be frank, I'd never heard, and to which I hadn't actually chosen to go. It caused me some mild embarrassment at the time, because, as you may know, they wore a distinct form of regimental belt as opposed to a Sam Brown, and I had already paid the club barman 10 shillings, which was a lot of money to me, to polish up my, as you might say, other Sam Brown, and had to set about getting a new one. However, I went to the 2nd Battalion and joined them at Basingstoke, where we were living in billets, and where I first learnt that I was to join 24 platoon of what we call Letter D Company of the 2nd Battalion, and I learnt that it was an airborne or glider-borne battalion, which I didn't until that moment know at all. I learnt subsequently that several people, including myself, were posted to what was then the 1st Air Landing Brigade to make it up to strength for training and subsequent operations. I joined D Company somewhat in trepidation that all the soldiers who I was about to command would know a great deal more about war than I did, but fortunately the battalion had come home, I think, from India in 1940, and although they trained very hard, they hadn't been in action, and indeed we didn't go into action until the 6th of June 1944. So all that time was spent in preparing for action and training in what I'm sure was a very hard and dedicated way, with a company commander who chased the living daylights out of us most of the time.
Who was that?
John Howard, Major John Howard.
In what way did he chase the living daylights out of you?
Well, he was an enthusiastic company commander, and he got us up very early every morning for runs before breakfast. He took us out on what seemed to be endless route marches. The company, indeed the whole battalion, marched back from Ilfracombe to Bulford, which was 120 miles in a week whilst I was serving with it, although I must admit I missed doing that myself, because I'd had my eardrum blown in on what was known as a confidence test at Woolacombe, where there was an assault course. But marching was very much the order of the day, and the normal test that we had to achieve was 22 miles in 6 hours with full equipment.
What is a confidence test?
A confidence test was designed to inspire confidence in those of us who had never been under fire. And we were lined up on the beach at Woolacombe in what I think you would call extended order. And instructors fired in front of us and behind us, and indeed over us, in such a way that you could neither go any faster or any slower, or if you did, you were likely to be hit by live rounds. My own particular instructor, I thought foolishly, threw a small homemade grenade, which landed by my left foot. I could now speed up my advance or slow it down, and it exploded and blew in my eardrum, for which I spent 6 weeks in hospital getting it right. But it was the time, if you remember, when everybody was trying to inspire us with military thoughts, if you know what I mean. You went on to the assault course, and people screamed, "Remember Hong Kong, remember Singapore." And at one stage, but not when we were doing it, I believe, had buckets of entrails and the like, so that you actually had blood splashed on you and felt even more aggressive than you otherwise might have done.
Did it have that effect?
Well, fortunately, as I say, they didn't do it to us. Perhaps somebody had objected and thought it wouldn't be helpful. I think anything they could do to make us feel that war was going to be as bad as it subsequently turned out to be was probably realistic. I mean, I think we'd been so long under training, it was difficult to assimilate the idea of real bullets and the like being fired at you, although we did do a lot of field firing in places like Cranbourne Chase and Studland Bay. And sadly, it was at Cranbourne Chase that I accidentally shot my fellow officer, Den Brotheridge, through the leg whilst waiting to take another section on a section attack exercise. Luckily or unluckily, as it turned out, it didn't do him any permanent damage, and after a few weeks in hospital, he was as right as rain. We knew at a very late stage, I suppose, that something was cooking, in that we were getting much better equipment and found it easier to get transport than we had previously, and we seemed to have far more senior officers coming to look at us and take an interest in us. And indeed we finished up, as you probably know, by having two platoons of another company attached to us, plus some engineers, and going on an exercise with them, which we learnt later was, of course, a rehearsal for the actual operation. Once my company commander knew what the plan was, and I think he knew that by about the 16th of April 1944, we spent our time rehearsing every conceivable and inconceivable series of events to get the drill right, so that whatever happened on the night in question, and of course we still didn't know where we were going, we'd get it right. And this, as luck would have it, turned out to be very wise when you remember that one of the gliders of the six involved landed on the wrong bridge about 11, I think, kilometres away.
In what kind of mood were you on the eve of going? Were you scared or eager or what?
Well, if we went into the transit camp about the 27th, I think, 26th of May at Tarrant Rushton, and we were locked up there, and the officers were first briefed from a remarkably accurate model with every detail of where we were going on it. And the next couple of days, or within the next couple of days, the soldiers were similarly briefed. And I think we all were raring to go. I'd had the same platoon for over 2 years, and only, I think, about three men in it had changed. And we'd already had a great disappointment at the time of the Sicily operation, when we'd been sent on embarkation leave, but weren't actually chosen to go. When we heard what happened in Sicily, we perhaps weren't all that disappointed. And as a small side issue to that, it was decided we should all learn to swim. And I took my platoon with others down to Yeovil, where we spent a week learning to swim. It's only since those days that I found that half my soldiers could swim already, but pretended they couldn't, so that they could avoid doing the chores that they'd have been left to do if they'd stayed in barracks. But going back to the transit camp, we were keyed up. We were ready. We didn't think we really could do any more training, and we wanted to get on with it and get into action for the first time, because I suppose we thought, although we knew D-Day was coming, that if we didn't get into action soon, we'd never fire a bullet in anger. You will remember that there was a false alarm, and we were all briefed and kitted up and ready to go, and then the whole operation was postponed for 24 hours. This was a severe shock to our morale temporarily, and I, who don't normally drink much, and another couple of officers bought two bottles of whiskey, which we demolished between us that night in our small tent. So I'm sure the general reaction was we were very disappointed that we weren't going. However, within the 24 hours from then, we went.
Can you tell me now, step by step, in as much detail as you can recollect, can you take me through the action chronologically?
I think so. The first thing we had to do in the transit camp still was to kit ourselves up with everything that we required for action. and to test our weapons, and we did this on the night before D-Day, and then we moved up to the airfield at Tarrant Rushton, where we emplaned in our Horsa gliders. In my case, it would have been my platoon plus some sappers, and I think we had a handcart on board as well. Certainly we had Bangalore torpedoes. We had had a meal which was supposed to stop us being sick, which we invariably were in flights in the gliders. On this particular occasion, perhaps because we were rather keyed up, I don't think anybody was sick. The gliders were towed by Halifax bombers, and I suppose we took off about 10 o'clock. The glider itself was overloaded, and the pilots had already told us that somebody would have to be taken off. And I remember having to make a decision about who shouldn't go on this particular operation to reduce the weight. However, there wasn't any problem in the flight itself. It was eerie and quiet, and nobody made much noise. I remember being asked by a couple of my men at the rear of the aircraft whether I would go back and have a look at something which appeared to them to be going wrong. I think we had a parachute in the tail of the glider, which was supposed to be let go as we landed to reduce the actual speed of landing. Anyway, I went to the rear of the glider. Of course, I couldn't really see anything in the dark, but I told the men it all appeared to be in order, and came back to the front, where I was sitting just behind the two pilots. We cast off as planned, and glid, I suppose is the word, for some minutes. We opened the doors. We kept very quiet because we had thought that we might possibly alert the enemy to the fact that we were coming. Quite suddenly and unexpectedly, the pilots said, "Christ, there's the bridge." And they put the nose of the glider down very steeply. The next thing I knew was that there were sparks coming from the skids underneath. They didn't have wheels. And I thought these sparks were actually enemy fire, but they were in fact the skids striking the ground. And then there was an almighty crash, and I was thrown out through the side of the glider, actually, landed on the ground, still clutching my canvas bucket of grenades, which I had added at the last minute to that which I was carrying already in the way of ammunition, in order to, I suppose, engage the enemy more effectively. I had my Sten gun and the bayonet of it still fixed, but wasn't in any way hurt. The rest of the platoon got out of the glider. Some were, like me, thrown out, and some got out through the doors. I collected them together. We knew exactly what we were supposed to do, although we didn't at that moment, of course, know where we were the first glider to land, or the second, or the third, because three were destined to land at our particular bridge. I took the platoon forward to where I knew the bridge was, and the road running up to it, and there, crouching in the ditch, was my company commander, who said, quite simply, "David, number two." And I knew that number two's job was to cross the road and sort out the enemy on the other side in the, I think we would call them, the inner defences of the bridge. There was an enormous amount of noise by this time going on, because 25 platoon under Den Brotheridge, who had landed just before me, were already crossing the bridge. And it was part of the training that we would make a lot of noise, I suppose partly to frighten the enemy, and partly to identify each other in the dark. My platoon, for instance, everywhere it went, shouted, "Baker, Baker, Baker," so that the other platoons would know who it was. I crossed the road, as we had planned to do. There was a lot of firing, but I think a great deal of it was probably put or could be put down now to our lack of experience. We'd never been under fire before, and we tended to fire at anything that moved, or which we thought could be, as indeed in some cases they were, the enemy. I personally came across a Smyser machine gun with a full belt of ammunition on it, which hadn't been fired at all. But I can't say that I saw a lot of the enemy running about or indeed running away. The whole thing was over very quickly, and I heard the magic words ham and jam on my, I think it was a 38 set radio, because that was carried by my Batman. And as we were, I think, consolidating, my company commander came up on the radio and said I was to report to him on the road for further orders. So taking my Batman with me, and for some reason the platoon sergeant, Sergeant Leather, had joined us, I started to make my way back to my company commander. When I was hit in the leg by what turned out to be a burst of three rounds of Smyser machine pistol, and fell to the ground, quite unable to do anything, I was extremely frightened. The grass was long, and I thought at any minute the chap who had fired at me was going to come and finish me off. So I shouted loudly. I didn't know at the time that both my batman and my platoon sergeant had been shot in the same, at the same time. But quite quickly a couple of men in the platoon came up, and they did what they could for my leg, put a rifle splint on it and gave me some morphine. And I was by really then effectively out of the action. I don't mean that I'd lost interest in what was happening to me. And later on, I was picked up and carried to a ditch, actually, not the famous Gondre Cafe where champagne was being lashed out to everybody, apparently, but to a ditch nearby in between the two bridges, that is the bridge over the canal and the bridge over the river. And whilst I lay in that ditch, or on my way to it perhaps, I did see the German armoured car come down, and I did see it hit by a Piat and burst into flames. I did hear the firing that was going on from the other bridge when the German officer came down in his staff car. I think he'd been out somewhere for the night. But as far as I was concerned, really, I was hors de combat. As daylight came, the Navy started its barrage, which was really more alarming than anything that had happened up until then, I think. These, to me, enormous shells came hurtling over where I was lying, and it really was a most frightening experience. Then, as daylight it got lighter, a sniper started firing into what I think they call the casualty clearing station in which I was lying, still within the company lines. And the medical orderly who was looking after me, unbeknown to me at that moment, drew his pistol to protect me, his patient, and unfortunately accidentally discharged it to the point where a bullet thumped into the ground just by my head, and I was convinced the sniper had seen me and the next one would be the end. But in fact it was just this REMC corporal who, with the best will in the world, had fired off the thing by accident. Later on that day I was moved on the back of a cart to Bainesville, where there was a field dressing station, where I lay for some time waiting for attention. No doubt there were worse people wounded than I was.
You mentioned ham and jam, but you haven't explained on tape the significance of those words.
No, well, the orders we were given in England included information, as is normal, I think, about the enemy and our own plan and so on. And at the end of the orders, we were told what the success signals were to be. And you had ham as a success for the canal bridge and jam as a successful capture of the river bridge. And these two words were well known to everybody, With hindsight, I think their selection by my company commander was not a very wise thing, because they were so easily mistaken one for the other, and it was very important which bridge had been captured and which possibly still remained to be captured. However, on the night it worked, and we had various other ways of communicating with our company commander if we'd been successful, other than on the radio, which I'm glad to say also worked.
Did the degree of German opposition take you by surprise or not?
We had been told what the size of the garrison was, and I think could have expected a far harder fight for the bridges than we actually experienced. In the first place, of course, we didn't know whether the bridges would be blown up by the enemy, and it was our sappers' job to make sure, as far as they could, that the charges, if they were laid, were not detonated. But having said that, there were a number of light machine guns and other defences there, including the small gun on the bridge itself, which is still there today. And I think, with hindsight, I was amazed that the whole thing was so quickly over, and we were so easily able, I think is what I want to say, to take our two objectives. I must add that, of course, later on there was, and we'd been warned there would be, a very determined counterattack to recapture the bridges, which wasn't successful.
What was this handcart that you mentioned?
Well, every platoon had what literally was a handcart. It was, you see, we had very little transport in an air landing battalion, which is what we were, and this handcart was used to carry all your extra ammunition and kit that you required, and which would normally be carried, I suppose, in the wheeled transport of an infantry battalion.
Oh, was it of sturdy construction?
Yes, it was like a light trailer, which you sometimes see being carried or pulled behind a car today, I suppose. You had a T-bar behind which was a box made of metal, and in it you had, of course, a load, which was exactly laid down, what you were supposed to put in it and so on, and you carried it round. It could, I think, be linked to the push to behind a jeep and pulled in that way. But it was all we had, really, for each platoon, in a way of what others would call transport.
Obviously, with a crash landing with a glider like this, you're asking for a certain percentage of your equipment to be rendered useless. To what extent did your own equipment in your own platoon survive?
As far as I know, we lost nothing from the actual landing. You will have seen photographs of the glider and what damage it was done to it. But I don't think we lost anything. One man we lost, but no actual equipment that I can recall was put out of action by the landing. Of course, the glider was made of plywood. And although that didn't afford you much protection if you crashed, it had the advantage of not confining you in the way that, for example, a metal Wacko glider of the type that the American Airborne Forces used, because the glider smashed up, and you were, in that sense, much better off, we felt, in a plywood glider than we would have been in one with a metal frame.
With the benefit of hindsight, you've criticised the use of ham and jam. Also, with the benefit of hindsight, do you think there could have been any other improvements in the mounting and organisation and planning of the operation?
No. We were in possession of all the information that anybody could have asked for. We made plans which were sufficiently flexible to take account of any circumstances that we were likely to meet, and these were rehearsed endlessly, both on taped areas of Salisbury Plain and, for example, on the two bridges at Countess Weir in Exeter, which somebody had cleverly discerned as being very similar to the actual bridges on which we were going to land in Normandy.
Which Weir?
Countess Weir. And I don't. I'm sorry.
Countess, like the wife of an earl.
Yes, that's right. We went down there before D-Day, and again carried out a succession of different plans to take account of any possible eventuality, which it was, anybody could foresee would happen.
From what you've read in the books that have been written about Pegasus Bridge since, do you think that they've got it right in what they say, or do you have any criticisms of what's been written in books like Stephen Ambrose and The Longest Day and so on?
Well, I know Stephen Ambrose, and I appreciate that he had a relatively short time in which to produce his book if it was going to be published by the 40th anniversary, as indeed it was. There are minor mistakes in it which others have pointed out to him, but from my own point of view I thought he did a remarkable research job to find out as much as he did from all of us who took part, and indeed from the other side, about what actually happened. The Longest Day, if we're referring to the film, well, there was a little bit of license used there, and I think this is likely to happen in any film which tries to condense a particular incident into so short a time.
To what extent have you been involved with the various celebrations and lionising, shall we say, that's gone on about the Pegasus Bridge in the years since?
Quite a lot. I think perhaps I should start by saying that Letter D Company is not universally popular in the annals of my regiment, because I think so much emphasis has been placed on that one single operation. And you must remember that the whole of the rest of the battalion landed on the night of D-Day and was subsequently involved in operations over the next few weeks, which were far worse in the sense that they caused far more casualties than we experienced on D-Day itself. I have been back many times for various actual anniversaries, and as a guest artist with the Staff College Battlefield Tour, and in the same capacity for Headquarters Northern Army Group, who have been back there. And I once recorded what happened to me in front of television cameras, and a programme was made as part of the Staff College year and what the students underwent during that time, which of course included the battlefield tour. The lionising, as you call it, of the bridge still seems to be very much alive. I went back with my company commander and Todd Sweeney, Dennis Fox and Sandy Smith for the 45th anniversary, and there was a remarkable turnout of veterans, as I think we're now called, on that occasion. And I think what everybody's looking forward to more than anything, of course, is the 50th anniversary, which I very much hope my company commander will be alive to see.
You've talked about